I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, the hot-button topic of the Israel-Palestine conflict is back in the news after a Human Rights Watch report strongly critiques Israel's treatment of Palestinians, going so far as to even use the term apartheid. Israel has responded by decrying the report as propaganda. The issue of Israel and Palestine is often a very difficult one to talk about because it stirs such strong emotions for all parties. And additionally, the concern always exists that criticism of Israel or even opposition to Zionism can be weaponized for anti-Semitism. At the same time, it seems unfair to dismiss all Palestinian grievances as being mere propaganda or anti-Semitic hatred. Philip Weiss has been writing about and commentating on these issues as they pertain to American Jewish political life for some years now through his website, Mondo Weiss. He is also likely one of the most prominent and public voices within a minority of the American Jewish community that describe themselves as anti-Zionist. Philip joins us on this edition of the show to discuss a number of topics related to American Jewish political life and the sea change occurring within the DC foreign policy beltway with regards to Israel. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. The Israel-Palestine conflict is, of course, a rather controversial and hot-button issue. But I hope you'll find my conversation with Philip Weiss to be one done in good faith and that contributes to a broader discussion. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Philip Weiss. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Beer knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I've been really interested in having on for some time now. Phil Weiss of Mondo Weiss. How are you doing today?
Good, JG. How you doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I was really happy to get in touch with you. And
my just pleasure.
For listeners that are unfamiliar, you're known, and you can correct me if I get any of this wrong, as being not only a journalist, but an anti-Zionist Jew, right? So yeah,
that's true.
I think some people hear that and they think, what does that mean? I thought, you know, isn't Zionism and Jewishness, aren't they completely interconnected? I still know people that think that, that aren't educated on these things. So what does it mean to be an anti-Zionist and Jewish?
Well, first, to be an anti-Zionist is a very broad category of humanity, I hope, or certainly it's a growing one. It's people who don't think that it's a good idea to have a Jewish state on lands that till very recently, historically, were Palestinian. And obviously, as a reference to Israel, it's not a... no, these are not people... I'm certainly not someone who wants Israel erased from the map. I want Israel to change and to cease to be a Jewish state. And in the process, I think its name would change, other things would happen. But anti-Zionists are people who it's a very broad category, but includes people who believe in the separation of religion and state, something, a principle that we take for granted in North America. To be an anti-Zionist Jew is to run counter to the sort of most important organizing force in Jewish life in the last 70, 80 years, even 100 years, and that is Zionism, a very important movement, political movement in Jewish life, that liberation movement, Zionists would say. But if you look at the last 100 years of Jewish history, you'll find periods in which anti-Zionists were a majority of the Western Jewish community, not the Russian or Eastern European Jewish community, and periods in which we've been a tiny minority of the Jewish community. And I think today we are a very small minority of the Jewish community, anti-Zionists, but a growing minority. And so when Zionist propagandists in the United States say that 95 or 97% of the American Jewish community is supportive of Israel, and supportive of a Jewish state, I don't think they're far off in fairness to them. I think it's probably 90% are very supportive of Israel and the idea of a Jewish state. But I'd say that there are a few who are confused, and that maybe 5 or 6%, I don't know, are anti-Zionist Jews like myself. I'm sorry to go on so long, but that's my answer.
So one thing that I found really interesting was a statement you made. I've seen it in multiple places where you mentioned that Theodor Herzl, who's sort of one of the founding fathers of Zionism, said that anti-Semitism made him Jewish again. And you actually, I think, said that in a way you almost... you know, relate to Herzl in the sense that you've said that neoconservatism, which was driven in large part by a number of right-wing Jewish intellectuals, brought you back to Jewishness. So could you talk a little bit about that, unpack that for us?
Sure. Let me just first address the hubristic part of that quote, which it's a funny quote. I like the quote. I like you bringing it up. So the hubris is that Theodor Herzl is a revered figure in Israel. I think he's a fairly minor figure historically in Jewish history, or he's a very political figure. I mean, not minor, but he's a very political figure, and he was something of a ridiculous figure in his time. I believe he died in 1904 at age 44, probably of syphilis. And but he was this early type. I mean, he was an early example of a type that we're very familiar with, and that is a very well-connected international man of the world, who's also gets into the is well connected, is well funded, and can get access to various courts and heads of state around the world. As Theodor Herzl did, he was invited. He met the Pope, he met the Kaiser, he met the Tsar, he met the, I don't think he met a president. He met the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. I'm getting a little adrift here. The funny part of it is that Herschel was a journalist like myself, and he was a feature journalist and not a very important journalist. I mean, in Eastern Europe, I mean, Austria, Vienna, he was, pretty well-known journalist. But his work was not that interesting until the Dreyfus case in the early 1890s, when he heard people saying death to the Jews in the streets of Paris and said, Zionism's the only answer. So he was an assimilating Jew. He had a Christmas tree. He didn't step foot in a synagogue. I don't think he was raising his kids Jewish. And then he heard death to the Jews and he said, I've got to save the Jewish people. We got to come up with a scheme. So I could relate. And it was very unpopular at the time, Zionism in Central Europe, where he was, and certainly in Western Europe, where he tried to raise money and support. So I'm part of a very unpopular movement in Jewish life, anti-Zionism. And I got a lot of my motivation. I'm certainly what people would call an assimilating Jew. It's too much of a pejorative to really dignify. I mean, I'm married to a non-Jew. I don't really celebrate the holidays that much. I'm very Jewish, culturally Jewish. I study Jewish history. I'm very involved in Jewish politics. So, I'm just Jewish. I was raised Jewish. It's just who I am. It's an important part of who I am is my identity is I'm Jewish. But I wasn't really a public Jew until my brother said in 2003 to me, hey, my Jewish newspaper says this war for Iraq, the invasion of Iraq is good for Israel. So I think I'm going to support it. I was shocked. I was against that war. And my brother was talking about something real, which is that neoconservatives, this right-wing group largely inside the Jewish community, intellectuals, had identified the Iraq war as something that would be very good for the United States and, by the way, for Israel. So I felt that war was such an awful thing. I wanted to show up as a Jew on that war and say, I'm against this war. I'm against it because I'm an American. I think it's very bad for America. I think it's bad for Iraq. I don't care about Israel on this war or generally. So I started, one of the things that followed from this revelation in 2003 was I had avoided the Israel topic all my life as a journalist. I had accepted a prohibition by neoconservatives. Actually, I met a neoconservative. I had a friend in college who was a neoconservative who, when I voiced some criticism of Israel's conduct back in 1975, almost 50 years ago, he said, Phil, you shouldn't be expressing these views until you know the history of the Balfour Declaration and of Transjordan, all this BS. So this friend of mine was giving me a literacy test on whether I could even talk about Israel. And this was 50 years ago. And the sad and pathetic thing is that I accepted the literacy test. This was a Jewish communal literacy test in which neoconservatives took control largely of opinion and activism and political engagement inside the Jewish community when it came to Israel. And the Jewish community allowed it. So I signed off on it. And it wasn't until the Iraq war that I said, I'm not signing off on this deal anymore. So in that sense, I reminded myself of Herzl. So again, JG, I apologize for the long answer.
Since we were talking about the neocons and the Iraq war, and we've mentioned sort of organized politics within Jewish life, I think people hear some of these things and they're immediately going to jump towards images of, like Henry Ford talking about the organized Jewry in the world and all these sort of anti-Semitic tropes. I'm curious, how do you respond to that type of thing? Because I don't think you're talking about the same thing that people like, a Kevin McDonald or some of these really, far right sort of anti-Semites are talking about.
I don't think I am. I mean, people have called me anti-Semitic. Certainly, it's a common accusation when you engage in Palestinian solidarity and when you criticize the Israel lobby, as I do, and when you identify the Israel lobby as an important factor in American political life, you were called an anti-Semite. So what makes
Could I just add one thing real quick?
Yeah, sure.
I guess what I wanted to add is there's obviously organized politics within any community.
Yes.
I want to draw out, where do you think the distinction is between talking about organized politics within specifically the Jewish community and, you know, these sort of tropes of, you know, a shadowy, organized, sort of international octopus sort of conspiracy theory trope that has commonly been associated with anti-Semitism?
You know, the problem is that there isn't a very open discussion of the power of the Israel lobby. And so some of the mystification and the grotesque caricature that exists of the Israel lobby is a consequence of the media failing to say what its powers are. And what the reason that they don't want to address the powers of the Israel lobby is that they are significant powers. Now, let's not use words like octopus and tentacles. Those are tonally offensive words. That being said, you cannot look at the Abraham Accords that were the foreign policy signature achievement, if you call it an achievement, of the Trump administration, in which Sudan, Morocco, the UAE, and Bahrain signed normalization deals with Israel. You had four or five Arab countries now have all but normalized relations with Israel. A stunning development geopolitically. You cannot look at that development without addressing the power of the Israel lobby in the United States. These countries made these deals in order to get access to Washington. And they thought that they concluded correctly that the address, the way to get to Washington was to go through Jerusalem and was to recognize Israel, and that they could then get the backing of very powerful forces in American politics, which they did. And so Morocco is getting gotten dispensation on its occupation of the Western Sahara, and Sudan is getting off some terrorist lists because it's signing this deal with Israel, just as Egypt and Jordan got a lot of gifts from the United States for signing a deal with Israel. Now, is there an American interest in doing that? Maybe, but certainly there is, you have powerful forces in American politics that will work for you so long as you are nice to Israel. And Turkey worked with Israel for years, was an ally of Israel for years. And as a result, American politicians didn't want to recognize the Armenian genocide. Now Turkey is on the outs with Israel, and American politicians are recognizing the Armenian genocide of more than 100 years ago. So what I'm getting at is that this is an important lobby in Washington. You can mystify it with all those horrible words, or you can try to be descriptive of its powers. I've tried to be descriptive of its powers, which are significant. And I think that the degree of its powers are so large in some cases with respect to American foreign policy in the Middle East, it has a lot of power. Look at the Iran business. But in any case, its powers are so significant that it conjures up anti-Semitic fantasies, and therefore the media do not want to foster those fantasies in any way. I recognize the impulse not to want to foster anti-Semitic fantasy. On the other hand, I think that there is an important role for journalists to describe how the world works and how foreign policy works. And the role of the Israel lobby was significant in the Iraq War. It wasn't everything, but it was a significant factor in Bush Cheney Rumsfeld's decision and ability to invade Iraq. A horrible decision. It's the Israel lobby's role was significant in Donald Trump tearing up the Iran deal in 2018. The Israel lobby was significant in opposing Barack Obama's signing of the Iran deal in 2015, to the point that Obama had to spend a lot of political capital on doing so. And it's a measure of the Israel lobby's power in Washington and its sort of transcendent power on these questions that although, to be clear, Obama defeated it. But it's a measure of the Israel lobby's power that not only did Netanyahu come and address a joint session of Congress defying the president in doing so in 2015, but Chuck Schumer voted against his own president and, rather than being shunned in the Democratic Party, became the minority leader, and then the majority leader in the Senate. So the party, the Democratic Party, elevated Chuck Schumer, even though he had defied Barack Obama on the most important achievement foreign policy-wise of the Obama administration. That is a reflection of the fact that the Israel lobby has power in Washington.
And for me, the other big difference is, I think the way you've talked about the Israel lobby, specifically AIPAC, although there's also now J Street, correct?
Yes.
I was going to say—
there are a number of organizations.
I think when we talk about these different organizations like AIPAC, we're talking about organizations that are out in the open. We're not talking about a shadowy cabal.
That's true. Although that is true. They are out in the open. On the other hand, some of their powers they don't like to advertise. AIPAC supported the Iraq war in 2002 and later lied about it, saying we were neutral. They weren't neutral. And, you know, similarly, when you talk about, there's a difference between talking about organizations and talking about, say, Jewish donors to the Democratic Party. As the New York Times has said, the fact that it's the elephant in the room, quote unquote, that Jewish donors make up some 60% of the Democratic Party's donations, political contributions, large 60% of the large political contributions in the Democratic Party come from Jews. What is the significance of this? If the Jewish community is 95% for Israel and 60% of your donor base, large donor base to a political party is coming from Jews, from people who are supporters of Israel, you're not going to go against Israel in your foreign policy making. And I think that it helps to explain why Biden has chosen such conservative positions on Israel. He's afraid of alienating the Democratic. He's afraid of sending big donors over to the Republican Party. And one of those biggest donors, Chaim Saban, right now is working with Jared Kushner. So these guys will, if it's for Israel, they will cross party lines, and the Democratic Party doesn't want that to happen.
Another issue that this brings up is, do you think there's maybe a tension between sort of unconditional support of Israel, or just a tension between Zionism and sort of the universalism of an ideology like liberalism?
Yes, there is. And if you were talking to J Street, a liberal Zionist organization and a member of the Israel lobby, if you were talking to J Street, they would say quite, I think, honorably, we're a liberal organization. We're for Democrats, not for Republicans. We stand for social justice values. And those values are in some tension with support for Israel. So we don't support Netanyahu. We don't support a lot of things that Israel does. And most American Jews don't support those things, don't support the settlements, J Street will say. Now, these are very vague pronouncements, because when push comes to shove, American Jews tend to side with Israel almost reflexively and without wanting to criticize Israel. Nonetheless, the Israel lobby is showing some diversity, greater and greater diversity, and J Street is a sign of that.
What sort of has drawn you towards anti-Zionism? Is it a belief in universalism? Is it just feeling a solidarity with Palestinians and their suffering? Could you explain that for my listeners a little bit?
That's a great question. So I've been an anti-Zionist for like almost 15 years, 10 to 15 years now. I mean, I had to figure out what Zionism was after being pretty ignorant. I would say that the things that draw me to it are, I like the word universalism because I don't, while I'm Jewish, I do not like membership in a tribal community. And when I mean, there are lots of tribes in the United States. Let me be clear. I think if I were born a Muslim, if I were born an Arab American, if I were born Christian American, I think that I would have become impatient with the narrow, what I would regard it as the narrow confines of my tribe, I temperamentally am not suited for that type of membership. I love the word universalism because I was raised in a very parochial environment in which we thought that we felt that Jews were smarter and in some ways superior to other people. And in any case, our people were Jews. We would socialize chiefly with Jews. And I did not accept those values as an adult. While I have great respect for Jewish achievements, cultural, academic, civilizational achievements, I don't think Jews are all that different from other people. And some of my closest, one of the things I discovered in life is that they're the great people whom I've made very close relationships with who are not Jewish. And I think that's a shock to the system of anyone who comes out of a tribal background. And it's just where I am more comfortable. I'm more comfortable with a very diverse community. And I think that diverse communities in the United States are healthy politically. And the opposite of that is Israel, where if you're not Jewish, you can't be in the government, really. And it's a horrible government. And there's the reason they're not unrelated. Zionism is the reason that's the case. So that's Zionism is really making the case for universalism every day because they behave in such horribly racist and exclusionary and oppressive ways, stopping people from marrying each other who are Palestinian because they live in the wrong places. And they're trying to keep these people in different places in these cantons like South Africa. It's an apartheid system. So the fact that Israel is practicing apartheid, which is more and more recognized by human rights organizations and some politicians too around the world, means that they're doing Israel's doing my anti-Zionist work for a lot of my promotion of anti-Zionism for me.
Do you think that any of that tension that we talked about with regards to maybe universalism versus Zionism, has any of that been coming out more and more within Jewish intellectual life? I know you've written about that from time to time.
The tension's always been there. It's an ancient tension inside Jewish life between universalism and parochialism, between the communal group and the wider world. I'm sure that's true of many other groups in the world. So with respect to Zionism and universalism, yeah, I think spring is busting out all over. That's my impression. And if you're a young Jew, I don't think that it's possible to square the two. Some of them who are very communal are having a lot of trouble accepting anti-Zionism full-throatedly, but they know there's a big problem. JG, where are you on these issues? Zionism specifically, but the universalism question.
I'm very pro-universalism. That's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, because I think there's very much this tension that has to exist between Zionism and especially the sort of expressions of it. We're seeing, you know, with the sort of Israeli right and, you know, having a universalist sort of belief system. I mean, I've seen some videos from Israel that I think were published by Max Blumenthal. He was doing some journalism there, where you had, you know, just really shocking statements being made by Israelis about Ethiopian Jews living in Israel. And it's mind-boggling.
Yes. Why are you a universalist?
Well, that's a deep philosophical question. I guess.
Well, but you brought it up. So
I guess because I believe that, you know, we all, I mean, this is going to sound trite, but we all bleed red. And I think we can live in a world that is much more cooperative, and we can just talk out our differences rather than, you know, trying to separate from each other.
I think that's a very good answer, and it's a helpful answer. So thank you.
So the next thing I wanted to ask about was, I guess, to play devil's advocate here. People,
go ahead.
I guess people will say, for instance, I have an article pulled up from Mondo Weiss called Why I Am a Zionist from 2015. And you cite Ken Silverstein, who's is actually a friend of the show. And he actually encouraged me to get you on the program. He said he very much respects your work. But in this piece, you quote him as talking about, you know, why he supports the Jewish state in the Middle East. And he says, you know, he can't forgive or forget about the crimes of the Germans against the Jews and millions more during World War II. And I can sort of relate to that point. I really can. You know, that idea that, well, what if this happens again? Where will my grandchildren go if something like the Holocaust could happen again? How would you respond to that?
Well, the easy answer, and I'll go to the broader answer in a moment, but the easy answer is that if I had kids, and I don't have kids, I wouldn't want them going to Israel. I think that that's not a good strategy for Jewish survival. I just, you know, when the proverbial crap hits the fan, that the Jews are gathered in one place and they're oppressing Palestinians. I don't know. It's just not a good strategy for survival. As to honoring history and not being naive about how history works, which I think would be the Silverstein position, that, hey, this really happened. You know, it happened in the most advanced society in Europe. It happened in recent memory for many people. It happened on a huge scale and an industrialized scale. And it called on a demonization of Jews that has never left the discourse of Jews as these kind of mysterious and nefarious, selfish agents in Western society. I can't argue with that, the truths of that, that these are all true things. What I would say is, from my standpoint, I mean, first, I recognize that some of my programming here is optimistic. And also, I don't think history repeats itself. So, or it rhymes, but it doesn't repeat itself. And so I think a lot of mechanisms were set up as a result of the Holocaust to try to prevent a recurrence of the Holocaust. And I think that with respect to Western societies and certainly the United States, I think they're working by and large. And there's been anti-Semitic violence in the United States, but it's not far and above or different from the scale of anti-Muslim violence. Actually, anti-Muslim violence, anti-Sikh violence, you could say is worse. In any case, I'm not trying to have a competition on that score. What I would say is I don't think it's going to happen again, that we're going to certainly try to head it off if it does. It certainly will happen to other people again. There are genocides again and again. That is a very predictable element of human conduct and civilization. And it's selfish for Jews to take the Holocaust experience and say, well, this shouldn't happen to Jews. No, it shouldn't happen to anybody. And I think one way that we can make sure it doesn't happen to Jews is to try to make sure it doesn't happen to anybody, which is, you know, one of the great challenges of civilization and on our tiny planet in the late, you know, in the 21st century.
Do you, I'm just curious, I know a lot of people have talked about how a dangerous game is being played by organizations that are now conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And the dangerous game being that when you conflate the two, I think that actually in some ways does a disservice to combating anti-Semitism.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Yes. It's a dangerous game. I agree with you.
I guess the last two things I wanted to ask about is you recently wrote a piece entitled, and this is why I originally wanted to have you on. I'm trying to pull up the piece. It's entitled "The DC Blob Undergoes Sea Change on Israel." That's at Mondo Weiss. My listeners are very familiar with this idea of the DC blob, the foreign policy consensus.
Great.
What exactly is happening? What is this sea change that's occurring with Israel?
Well, I think that, and I don't take credit, anti-Zionism cannot take credit for this. It goes again to the atmosphere you just described, in which criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic and that dangerous part of it Israel is behaving in many dangerous ways, I believe. And I think finally it's catching up with it in the mainstream. So that Israel was given a little over half the land by the UN back in under this plan in 1947. And the Jewish state was not content with that 56% of the land. And ever since, it's been trying to get more of the land. And so it signs deals in which it agrees to a partition of the land, and then it just keeps devouring more of the land. And so that's been the case for 75 years. And 74 years. And I think there's been this feeling of, well, wait, do they defy physics? Does Israel get away with this forever? They're violating they after the 67 war, they started moving their population into the West Bank. They have over 650,000 settlers in the West Bank. It's, you know, and it's devoured the political structure. How long can they get, they're defying the international law and consensus. How long can they get away with this? And the Israel lobby has been able to give Israel impunity on this. No criticism of Israel, just keep giving them money for, you know, 50 years of occupation and more. And I think that what is remarkable about this story that you brought up, and again, not my achievement, I'm just reporting on it, is that the two-state solution is now dead, and a number of mainstream organizations, including in the Blob, recognize this and are angry about it.
I want to add something to that real quick. Certainly. I mean, we have Ben Rhodes coming out now complaining about pro-life could bias in the media. And I think this is an example of what you're talking about.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, John Kerry is the one who said, poof, there went the two-state solution. You know, we opposed settlements and poof, you know, you couldn't do it. That was nearly 10 years ago. And I mean, these people are, you know, establishmentarians who go along and get along, and they're sick of it. They're sick of it, and they should be. And so I think what I was referring to specifically was the Carnegie Endowment for an International Peace saying, no, there will not be a two-state solution. We need to start looking at equality. We don't care if it's one state, two state, how many states. We need to start working for equality for Palestinians, something the left has been saying for 10 or 15 or 20 years. And that Carnegie report came out at the same time and seemed to anticipate the Human Rights Watch report that came out last week that said it's apartheid and there should be international efforts to prosecute Israel for the crime of apartheid, including the settlements. And that aligns with the International Criminal Court saying, defying the conventional wisdom of saying, yeah, we're going to try to prosecute Israel for crimes against humanity, for its war crimes, for the settlement thing. So I think, I'm sorry, JG, that I'm so long-winded, but I think that what we're seeing is that this impatience that you and I would have reflected at more grassroots level is now being reflected by experts inside the Beltway who've said, look, this is what it is, and we've got to start pushing. It's a joke to talk about the two-state solution, though everyone in the Democratic Party does. It's a joke. We know it's not going to happen. We've got to start pushing for rights for Palestinians.
Didn't Peter Beinart even come out recently saying that he was
very important? Yes, Peter Beinart, formerly a liberal Zionist, maybe still, I don't, you know, formerly taught, he used to do events for AIPAC. He was a right-wing Zionist and supported the Iraq war. Peter Beinart has very honorably come out for one state of democratic rights. I think that was quite a blow to the liberal Israel lobby.
So in closing, because I know we're very short on time, you've been very generous with your time. Oh, I want to thank you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate your patience with my schedule, and your questions are excellent. So
I just wanted to get in closing, if you could just real briefly here.
Definitely.
How can my listeners keep up with your work and other writers at Mondo Weiss? And also, do you think there's hope for the future? I mean, we've seen what has happened to Gaza, the West Bank. I mean, is there a hope for, you know, a better future when it comes to these issues?
Great question. So I would say, first, on keeping up, it's very easy to keep up on this issue, you know, if you want to. There's a lot of resources online. The website I work for is one of them, but there are many. And I think your readers are pretty sophisticated, or your listeners are sophisticated. Is there hope? That's a temperamental question. I'm a hopeful person, so my answer is yes. I think that these things can change very swiftly and that they don't have to be violent. And that I believe we are beginning to see some of the paradigmatic shift that took place with, we forget that South Africa was once in good odor before it was in bad odor. And it happened under the Reagan administration that the Congress sort of turned on South Africa and Reagan couldn't, he couldn't veto the sanctions legislation. I think we're beginning to observe something of that shift in American public life. Yesterday, Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman from Michigan, who's of Palestinian descent, tweeted pictures of settlers burning olive trees and fields of Palestinian villagers in the northern West Bank and said, this is apartheid and we cannot stand by. We must withdraw our aid. Now, what's remarkable about that is that Rashida Tlaib is going to survive that. And in the past, politicians were punished for such explosions of sentiment, of views, not sentiment. And I believe that Tlaib is going to be a major factor in progressive politics in the United States. She's a wonderful politician, a wonderful person. You can just see, just a splendid speaker. And she is not going to lose her job, I don't think. And the Israel lobby will not be able to take her down. And there will be elements of the Israel lobby that, like J Street, which has not endorsed her because she supports BDS. But J Street will not be able to oppose her. They will not. The young Jews are so progressive on this question or moving that Rashida Tlaib is going to have some traction even inside the Jewish community. And that to me is a beautiful thing to watch. As a hopeful person and a universalist, it's just beautiful to see someone stand up for human rights, stand up for these people who are being oppressed. Let us not forget, this is oppression and persecution before our eyes. These colonists in these communities who are never stealing land and then burning their trees. It's just so horrifying with the United States supporting that country. I find it so horrifying. And the good guys are beginning to speak out more and more forcefully. This is the hopeful thing, I would say.
Thank you again, Phil Weiss.
Okay, JG, thank you very much for your patience with my answers.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Philip Weiss. Like I said at the beginning of the show, this episode ended up dealing with some very hot-button topics that really stir very strong emotions, and I hope we handled it fairly and frankly without contributing to any kind of bigotry. I want to thank Phil Weiss for coming on the show, being so generous with his time. I know we usually do 60-minute episodes here on Parallax Views, but we could only do 40 minutes. Some future guests, I think, may also be limited in their time, so you may see more of these episodes that are less than an hour long. I don't think that'll be a problem. I think you can cover a lot of ground in 40 minutes. In any case, again, I want to thank Philip Weiss for coming on Parallax Views. If you were interested in what he had to say, check out his writings at Mondo Weiss, which also features a number of other writers and commentators on issues pertaining to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ben, Brian, Catherine, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.